Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Lisette Baron Carvajal, a host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Bianca Premo about her wonderful book, The Enlightenment on Trial, Ordinary Litigants and Colonialism in the Spanish Empire, published by Oxford University Press in 2017. Welcome, Bianca. We're so excited to have you.
Thank you, Lisa. I'm delighted to be talking with you today.
Okay, so to our listeners, this is a fantastic book, and we're so excited to be having this conversation. But we'll start this interview by asking about what we usually ask, and it's if you can tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came to study history and Latin American history in particular.
Sure. It's always so interesting because for such a long time, I was really jealous of people who had crazy adventure stories or family who were from Latin America or some kind of, you know, kind of tight and neat reason for beginning to study Latin American history. But for me, it was really a combination of great teaching and falling in love with the region itself. Of course, everything always takes place in a political context. And so when I was an undergraduate student, it was the end of a particular kind of era of political activism around Central America. And there was a very almost kind of confusing lull in the late 80s and early, late 80s, early 90s, in terms of thinking about what was happening on the left in Latin America. And as someone who'd been attracted to the study of Peru from early on, Sendero Luminoso and questions of indigeneity and who claimed the native past were very present and very violently present for Peruvians. So that was kind of the context in which I started studying. And my initial interests were super contemporary about the interesting, you know, and sadly, continuing definition of what we call terrorism, because at that point, there was a lot of talk of narco-terrorism. And those were really, you know, kind of almost political science-y questions. But when I kept thinking about indigenous history, who gets to claim history, who speaks for the past, I just kept sliding backward into the colonial period.
Oh, that's great. So can you tell us maybe a little bit more so how you came to write this particular book, how you got into this fascinating topic that you develop in The Enlightenment on Trial?
Yeah. And I'd love to. And I also think that maybe I want to preface it by saying that my own background, I have family members who got PhDs, but aside from my very small family, my larger family didn't necessarily go to college. I paid my way through undergrad. And I'm just kind of thinking back now, your question prompted me to think about how, like, the long trajectory, how somebody ends up with a project. And I just wanted to say that I feel like I was very privileged to go to college in a time when there was less pressure to produce the kind of usable skills-based knowledge. I know that sounds crazy, and, you know, but it was a time when being able to follow questions, political questions, questions that had really, you know, pressing significance for the world in which we were living, where there was a kind of more room for creativity in following those questions, you know, through time. So I went from being very interested in Andean colonial history, early conquest. Then I went to get a master's program, and my mind was opened to thinking about the history of gender and combining it with questions of ethnohistory. My training there under people like Kevin Gosner and Donna Guy impacted me. When I went to my PhD program, I was committed to colonial Peru, but I started to put those things together, and I asked questions about who was a legal minor. And that was originally a very question that was very steeped in ethnohistory. If indigenous people were considered to be minors before the law, what about their parental rights? So this is kind of a long way of saying each set of questions and each set of exposures, sometimes to things I wasn't even looking for, led me in a new direction. And I was not looking in the first book that I wrote, which was called Children of the Father King, to write anything about the Enlightenment. I didn't even really think I understood what the Enlightenment was, but I found all of this dynamism around childhood and legal questions, especially for the second half of the 18th century. And I found more and more civil cases that involved kind of more and more ordinary people or enslaved litigants. And I noticed that the numbers of cases and also the kind of talk about rights or about education, about natural rights and freedom, it really seemed qualitatively as well as quantitatively different in the second half of the 18th century than in earlier centuries. So when I finished that book, I was left with the question about whether or not this was just confined to legal cases that dealt with children or whether it was a broader phenomenon. And there, you know, the comparative method was the only, you know, was the single answer, the best answer for trying to answer that question. What was happening with all that dynamism at law in the second half of the 18th century?
And yeah, I mean, I think this is probably the main argument of your book, right? Is that something was happening and that something was enlightenment. So maybe we can start like the discussion of the book with enlightenment, and maybe like you do a terrific job in explaining the meaning of the word for different authors, for kind of different schools of thought. I recommend this the introduction and the book in general for anyone that wants to like understand the concept and also the critiques and kind of want to see different nuances of this debate, because it's still, I think, an ongoing debate. But maybe you can tell us what it means. What is enlightenment? And how did you situate it yourself in a debate that has been so heated and so important for like decades right now?
Yeah, it's so the problem of enlightenment, and it is indeed a problem, and it was during the period when people began to label what was called a new philosophy or new approaches to life, right? These are this is a concept that lots and lots of philosophers, obviously, and policymakers talked about. There was a certain amount of temporal self-reference that was going on in the second half of the 18th century. And so at one level, we can talk about what the Enlightenment meant to people at the time and how they called it by its name. But of course, the Enlightenment became somewhat detached from the 18th century over time. And particularly the way that we think about it is heavily influenced by developments in the post-Second World War period, at the hands of scholars from the Frankfurt School, who saw the Enlightenment as the foundation of a homogenizing kind of state-led process that had seeds of fascism and would lead to the eradication of, or the attempts to eradicate difference in the Holocaust. And it also had a life among both post-structuralist, but also post-colonial scholars who saw it as kind of the unfulfilled promise or trickery of modern imperialism and the modern state. So we get a real package of things when we talk about the Enlightenment. And the way Michel Foucault talks about it is that there's an event, which is that original way that folks in the 18th century had an epical self-consciousness. They talked about when they were living and saw it as distinct from other periods in the past. And then there's this ethos, which is this whole idea that we're breaking through history that then gets taken up as an avatar by critics of modernity, I should say. So when you talk about the Enlightenment, you're dredging up something that has a lot of baggage. And I try in this book to ask myself, what happens if we try to look at the way that ordinary people who often did not read or write in Spanish and delegated their legal writing to others, how did they think about living in their moment as different? Or what were the features of the newness of the 18th century to them? And I come up with answers that are intrinsic to colonial Spanish America. In other words, they're not derived by me looking at French historiography and saying, okay, here are the features of the French historiography tells us should be present in the Enlightenment. Or here are, you know, the kinds of thoughts that one must adhere to in a cosmopolitan republic of letters. Let's say, for example, to be kind of theologically committed to tolerance or to have a certain kind of metaphysics. That's something that a scholar like Jonathan Israel would tell us. Those kind of measuring sticks, I try to abandon those and just allow the sources, the lawsuits themselves, to tell me how ordinary people and their lawyers and judges were casting the moment as new. And it has very clear parameters. They are historicists. There's new meaning given to natural rights. There's a new way of thinking about what freedom means. And those features all kind of combine to create an Enlightenment that is an ordinary Enlightenment among Spanish Americans.
Yeah, and I think here you in the introduction, you say that calling practices or arguments or referring to them as enlightened can appear to be a case for the Enlightenment as a capitulation for traditional narratives of the rise of the West. Yet you say that making such a critique that all Enlightenment is Western imposition or imperialism or whatever, that assumes two things that you're actually trying to critique. And first is that ideas have origins and owners. Mm-hmm. And then the second one, and that is what I want you to talk a little bit about, is what you term here the denial of coevalness, which I don't know if I'm pronouncing. Okay. So can you tell us what this means, this denial of coevalness? What are you trying to kind of tell us there with this concept of this idea of?
Right. That's a great question. So that I borrow from Walter Mignolo, mm-hmm. who in fact has adopted it himself.
Okay.
But that is so, and his argument about that is that Latin America is staged such that he's looking at an earlier period. This would be in his work on the darker side of the Renaissance. Right. And so there are lots of historians and lots of literary scholars, Mignolo included in an earlier version, who remind us of the importance to modernity of contact and the encounter between the so-called new and old worlds themselves. And what is at the basis there is the historicist idea of stages of history, that Latin America always is a recipient, a laboratory that is acted upon. It's not simply that it's behind, but also that it is not generative of any of the features or experiences of the stages of history that we see as the universal stages of history. And in many ways, that's what historicism has meant. It is a reference to world history in which Europe and the so-called West as an imaginary generates all of the stages that are the important ones. You know, the Renaissance, industrialization, modernity, the nation state. Those things have to kind of take place, and everywhere else is in some either deformed version of that or in a lag time. That would be the denial of coevalness. But to assert coevalness is to recognize that these in this interdependent global world, the West is not created without its referent in the other, which can be through the act of colonialism. But there's even more, I think, than just pointing out that the West can't create itself without contact with the other. And that is that I think in this book, I'm making a case for the fact that ordinary people in Spanish America are in fact experiencing at the same time and generating at the same moment the same kinds, roughly the same kinds of concepts that are occupying the minds of the great philosophers or Enlightenment thinkers that we have enshrined in history. So to open our minds and imagine that this could happen and that ordinary people who are not philosophers have an intellectual history and that intellectual history has a bearing on some of these big events and markers in Western history actually is really subversive in many ways to the not only to the kind of Western civ story, but in some ways a little bit subversive to the where we've been in post-colonial studies for maybe the last 20 years.
And I mean, I agree. I, as a student of the history of science and medicine in Latin America, I agree that saying that ordinary people produce enlightened ideas, it's a very powerful idea that certainly hasn't been addressed or hasn't been made enough by scholars. So this is a terrific like intervention that makes this claim so powerfully and with so many numbers. And this, I would like to invite our listeners, because it's, I think the work you do in counting, in telling us how many people, you know, how many women, you know, pursued suit against their husbands, how many enslaved people did it against their masters, like how many indigenous people. It's amazing to see the sheer number of cases and how it increased.
Yes. And sometimes it's not even just that the numbers are so incredibly large. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is important that we always keep in perspective that it's not, it, you know, the going to court was probably, you know, as unfamiliar to ordinary colonial Latin Americans as it is to us. In other words, or just as familiar. I mean, the relative rate of litigiousness or encounters with the law is a really hard thing to measure. But what you see is that the use of law changes over time. So I think it's really important to embrace the documentation on its own terms, which is to say, a lot of times we in colonial Latin America have lots of legal documentation and not a lot of other stuff. And we've maybe been a little bit hesitant to write about the law because we desperately wanted lawsuits or legal writing to provide us a window into the world beyond the law. And I have my thoughts about how effectively it can do that. But in, at least in the confines of this book, I find it really helpful to think about the law itself as a place that changes over time. Right. In other words, the same people weren't going to court at the beginning of the 18th century as were at the end of the 18th century. And the only way to make that point is to count. Right. It's really the only way to get a handle on the role of the law in people's lives and how ordinary people changed the law itself.
Yeah, and I think here, this is like one of your other main points, is that you see a shift, though not necessarily complete or straightforward, between what you call a justice-oriented culture to a law-oriented culture, right? So can you explain what these two concepts are and how do you see that shift and transformation in the 18th century?
Yes. So the justice-oriented culture actually, I believe, still informs Latin American legal culture, very strongly today. And it was fundamental to the way, just to kind of put it out there, the way liberalism in Latin America looked. So if we stop imagining that liberalism was imported from somewhere else, but see it rather as a development within Latin American legal culture, it's important to understand what the baseline was. And the baseline for justice-oriented culture is both established by the idea that people went to court instrumentally. They were not necessarily looking for full suits with judgments. They looked to judges as one of multiple different kinds of potential mediators on matters of justice. They thought a lot about, they conceived of themselves not as individuals bearing rights, but rather as members of corporate groups. And this is where, Spain's medieval history of fueros, or special prerogatives at court, really matters. When somebody identified themselves in the court records, it's always very relationally, right? I belong to this town. I'm a natural of such and such a place. I'm married to so and so, and I fall into this kind of protected or special legal category. And so if you kind of take all of that together, the resolution to cases was not necessarily about asserting rights, but rather about tapping into certain kinds of privileges and having those privileges give you an advantage that would allow you to win your part of justice at law. The law wasn't applied. It was kind of mediated through the judge. The judge could give this person their justice and that person another their justice. How did they do that? Well, they look to which laws in this huge kind of history of laws that blended Roman, canon, Spanish law together with commentators. If you could find some kind of legal idea or opinion that supported your position and it could lead to a kind of distributive outcome, that was great. You didn't necessarily need to go to court. Maybe you did, but you could invoke the law very instrumentally. This changes across the 18th century. It does not become totally displaced, but a new way of thinking about the law arises. And that is where individuals began to focus on seeing a case all the way through to the end and getting a judgment. It involved having natural rights at law that accrued to an individual that were not necessarily dependent on one's corporate standing, though that never totally goes away. But nonetheless, the idea that you would have kind of a natural right to be able to litigate and see a case seen through to the end, that's really very new. And it really relied less on the idea of finding just a statute in law or a legal commentator to support, but what was the most current and useful ruling. There's a lot more reference to precedent over time, which has a lot of implications for how people were thinking about history and their place in it. So hopefully that's hopefully I did an okay job in summing it up. But those are, the legal law-oriented argumentation really detaches from tradition in those fundamental ways.
Yeah, I know. I think you do, like right now, you just made a great explanation. And throughout the book, as a reader, you get explained over and over again what this difference is. And sometimes, of course, the change is not obvious. Like sometimes there are like gray areas, right, or gray cases. And as you said, in Latin America, justice-oriented systems still exist. But I think throughout the book, yes, you do show the transformation and the nuances. And it's very interesting to see how that changes in specific cases that we'll talk later. But now maybe we can talk about the scope, right? Because this is not a, yes, book about one place. This is a book about New Spain, about Peru, about Spain. So can you tell us a little bit about these regions? You choose cities, you choose rural spaces, indigenous communities, but cosmopolitan cities at the same time. You include Spain as a kind of control case to see how things work differently in colonial Latin America. So can you tell us this choice of cities, villages, and this like transnational scope that you're like, you know.
Yes. First, I want to say that it always gives me pause. It is completely true that Spain, and especially the region of the Montes de Toledo, which is a rural region around the city of Toledo, was a control case. But I learned so much about rural Spain and about Spanish legal culture that it just it feels like such a disservice to say that it's no more than a control case. But it is, in the sense that there is a social science scaffolding to the book in which I am kind of careful about choosing regions that will present different features so that I can talk about causation. In order to talk about causation, you have to choose different regions that have different kinds, both similar and different kinds of variables. So how do we know that the Enlightenment is spurring more litigation on the part of ordinary people in Spanish America? You have to be very careful to not just choose regions that all have the same, for example, demographic profile. If every single place has more and more inhabitants over the course of the 18th century, they're growing at the same rate. It could just be that urban growth or the growth of a population leads to more litigation, right? So those very careful kinds of variables all went into where I chose to study, both demographic differences, how many enslaved people, how many indigenous people, what kind of rural people. But one of the big things, as we know, anybody who works with anything that looks like statistics prior to the 19th century, we all have to be really careful, because what's preserved in the archive may not be everything that there was. And so the first thing I had to do was find regions that had excellent archives, as transparent as can be, holdings, meaning, great people to talk to. The archivists were so central to this project for me, because I would have these conversations about if they knew if there were other civil cases tucked away in the basement somewhere that maybe weren't counted and that kind of thing. So that was a big part of it, of selecting the regions. And the other part of it is places that had great historiographies. Richard Kagan did one of the most foundational studies about lawsuits and litigants in Spain, and he used the archives of the Montes de Toledo. It's really the archives of the municipality of Toledo, but he looked at this region. And so he stopped in the 18th century. So I was able to use some of his evidence for earlier centuries to talk about change over time. And this was true, too, of the excellent research that's been conducted on Trujillo in northern coastal Peru and in Oaxaca. I followed in the footsteps of so many great historians who've used legal records in the past. And that helped me a great deal in being able to make arguments about change over time.
I guess before moving on to like the examples you provide in the chapters, I want to ask you, and maybe so our listeners can have a clear sense of your book, why did you choose civil cases? Because you mentioned that, maybe that the changes can be seen maybe in criminal cases too, or in other jurisdictions, but you focus on civil cases. Can you tell us why you do that, and why is it important to analyze those cases?
Absolutely. First of all, I mean, there's lots of interesting work, and people have found all kinds of interesting things in civil cases, but civil cases definitely are the less favored child of legal history compared to criminal cases. Criminal cases are just so much more inherently interesting and compelling. And, but there's something really persuasive about thinking about agency in civil cases. And I've been thinking a lot. I tried not to theorize about it too much in the book because, you know, monographs can only handle so much theorizing before they start to collapse under their own weight. And there was a lot going on with trying to theorize out the Enlightenment. But I was thinking a lot as I wrote this book and continue to think a lot about what I would call the new archival history, which in colonial Spanish America, so many people are doing such fascinating work in thinking about the archive theoretically. And one of the things that I've noticed about a lot of that work is that it does have a tendency to drift towards criminal cases, or sometimes Inquisition cases, which share some characteristics in common in terms of the compelling narratives, and you know they capture some of society's craziest behaviors, and in that way they're fabulous. But those kinds of institutions and criminal courts in particular also are places in which are filled with silences and violences. And I think that that is incredibly important, but it also can distract us from seeing how ordinary people try to commandeer institutions for themselves. And while I'm not, I don't think I use the word agency once in the book, and it's not necessarily the kind of center point of what I'm doing here. I'm not theorizing about people's subjectivity or agency in some kind of sense about their role to act on history. I do think that civil cases offer us such a fabulous advantage because to be a litigant is very rarely something that you must do, unless you are compelled by certain circumstances. Enslaved people's freedom suits, we can talk about whether or not you're compelled to do that, or a human being is compelled to do that. Obviously, the stakes are very high. But there is some kind of an act of volition that it takes to enter court, to decide along with your legal counsel and the agents who are writing up your cases where your case might be most favorably seen. So asking which kind of jurisdiction or what kind of case it's going to be. Are you going to take it to church court? Are you going to go to the Inquisition? Is this a matter that could be criminal? Are you going to sue for abuse? Are you going to sue for back, like restitution or return of money? Those are all places where I think we can see ordinary people making very clear intellectual and kind of legal cultural decisions. And I think that they've been overlooked. I think civil cases, because so often they're super boring. in contact, we've tended to over. They yeah, can be. Oh my God. Yeah. Like sometimes the inheritance stuff, you'll be in the middle of a 300 page thing and you're thinking, why am I spending so much time with this and trying to understand the legal maneuverings? But if we just take a step back, and I really try to do that in the first chapter of the book and say, okay, let's not get into the details yet. Let's just ask the question about why a person decides to sue, not about the outcome. That really, to me, is just such a compelling question. How did they end up in court in the first place?
Yeah, and here I want to jump in because I want to flag for our listeners the structure of your book, which is divided in two parts. And the first part, it's called Suing in the Spanish Empire. And here you devote to the legal and juridical structure of the Spanish Empire. While in the second one, titled Lights from Litigants, you kind of focus on the example of specific litigants, right? In women, indigenous people, and the enslaved. But going back to that first chapter that I cannot recommend enough to our listeners, whether they're historians by trade or just people that want to understand how the process of history writing works, that I, you know, it's just such an important chapter for historians to read when they're going to, where they're going to go to the archives, so they can understand, we can understand as historians or as people are interested in history, how history works and how the documents that we see in the archives kind of get crafted and done. And I really appreciated how you kind of tell us about the materiality of these documents, the type of paper, how much it cost, who wrote it, how can you get to the identity of the writers, intermediaries, what was the role of the person that sued in this process. So can you tell us about that chapter that you titled Agents and Powers, Litigants and Writers in the Courts? Like, why did you write that chapter and how much work was it? Because it seemed like a lot of work.
It probably was. Yeah, it's like an accumulation of so many questions. And, you know, maybe I'll say it this way. That chapter is such a product of always feeling like I was on the outside looking in so many ways. And what I mean by that is that I wasn't trained in law. I never, unlike many legal historians who have JDs, I do not. And I always had the sense that other people understood things about how these cases ended up written the way that they were or who was doing the writing. And I somehow was not clued in. And I'm not really sure. I know I asked a lot of times, you know, who's doing this writing or why isn't this person signing? Because I noticed that when lawyers, the abogados made their grand arguments, they wrote in the third person and signed their names and they were, you know, characters in this story, but there were all these other pages that just seemed to be in the name of the litigants with no identifier for who was doing the writing. And when I would talk to people who I assumed knew the answer, they would kind of say, well, it was the lawyers or the procuradores, right, who are the kind of also legal professionals, but who don't do the grand legal arguments at the end. And I kept thinking, no, I see those guys show up and put their name on things too. So this is really strange. Where are these papers coming from? And a lot of my question and my attention to that was formed from the confidence that everyone else knew the answer and I didn't. And I needed to catch up and learn it and figure out, you know, what I had missed in my graduate training or along the way. And suddenly, I don't know when it occurred to me that none of us knew this, that we all assumed that we should know who was doing the writing, yet there was this mystery there. And it, I mean, you know, Catherine Burns wrote a great book about notaries that came out while I was, in the process of writing this book. And that filled in a lot of the shadows, but it didn't fill in all of the shadows because she was looking specifically at notaries and paid a lot of attention to contracts as well as criminal cases. But again, the notaries of court for criminal cases were identified and were the interpolators for people who were actually kind of caught up in a legal system. And notaries of the court are not necessarily those who are doing the legal writing in civil cases, which are more litigant driven. So I do hope people will take a look at this because it occurred to me only as I was, you know, trying to catch up and fill in my insecurity, what I thought I should already know, that I realized that I was onto something that we hadn't figured out. And that was really about the role of what we might call the agente. And the agente is just a catch-all term for some semi-official and lots of improvised delegated writers who had familiarity with the forms of litigation and could write petitions for people, but wouldn't sign their names to them. And they kind of worked on a piecemeal basis, a couple coins, and they would write up a petition for someone. And they could continue to intervene in disputes, kind of working together with litigants long after official procuradores and abogados, after lawyers were named. So that gives us the idea or allows us to see that litigants were involved in their cases oftentimes, especially at the beginning, in very active ways, that an emphasis on the delegation of writing and thinking to others might otherwise cover up.
I have to say, as someone doing archival work right now, I really appreciated that chapter, and no one has explained to me, you know, the type of the documents that I see, who wrote them, you know, and the fact that you're kind of explaining that, and also, not only that, but also how did someone, you know, get to ask this agente to write it for them, right? How much they likely paid, to what extent were they involved in the process or not, like all of these things. I think they're super important for historians, but also for people that want to understand how history happened, like how historians also write their histories, because we go to the archive and we read these documents and sometimes we're expecting to, like, you know, get a, you know, very interesting case, but we're not asking about who is producing it, how is it produced, what That's is, right. you know, the fact that there has to be a certain quality of paper or depending on, you know, the jurisdiction. I don't know. There were so many things that you kind of helped me understand.
Yes. And just try to figure out that the filing of those cases, and even the order that they're put in, serves the bureaucracy. And it's not necessarily chronological. It tells you about, this is what the kind of new archival history is doing such a great job of, but it reproduces a particular kind of logic that makes sense to the court, right? Especially when you're in the archive of the Indies in Sevilla, where I know you are now, a lot of that's done by copyists, right? And it almost always is chronologically out of order. It starts at the end with the decision and then circles back. And so chronologically, you're kind of all over the place. It can be very disorienting if you're trying to read a narrative chronologically. But when you break it apart and begin to look at the pieces and the paper and the kind of handwriting and repetition, a lot of times I found that lawyers just repeated what had been written in letters that were kind of, we would say, crudely written, or written by bilingual, from rural, especially indigenous areas. I mean, a lot of the initial petitions are written by bilingual scribes of some nature, whether they're the notaries of the indigenous cabildos or other kinds of writers around. And a lot of times, you know, of course, once those things get metabolized into the court system, you get, you know, erudite and technical writings that begin to kind of churn up the original petitions. But I found just as frequently those early stages, the lawyers are just repeating what the early petitions said. So, you know, it really is important to look at the dates and ask yourself what kind of handwriting. I'm no handwriting expert, but I spent a lot of time flipping back and forth to see if the handwriting had changed, right? Because, and to try to figure out if the litigant had gone to get another writer, a fourth writer, a fifth writer. And I think one of the most amazing things, and I think what really needs to be said, is part of the reason people haven't been asking these questions is not because they're just distracted with other things, but there's a really interesting and still to be explored and really interrogated quality to legal writing in the colonial Spanish Empire, in which that whole process of finding agentes and delegating writing actually gets covered up, which is to say, why is everyone writing in the first person and making it seem as if, let's say, someone who was born in Africa and barely speaks any Spanish or speaks no Spanish at all is writing his own petition in legal language to the courts of the viceregal capital of Lima? If you read some of these cases, they'll have you believe that this litigant came in and, you know, and there's no trace of who's doing the writing. There is something literarily and kind of historically significant about the first person in those cases, about the way that the writing itself attaches subjects to their cases and disappears the legal writer from the whole equation. And I think we still need to do more work to kind of understand what that means about legal and political subjectivity in the empire.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you do a terrific job in, like, kind of putting this topic or bringing this topic to the table so other scholars can later on pursue their own questions and kind of tackle these still unknown aspects of legal history. Now I would like us to move to the second part of your book that in a way is kind of the heart of your project, I feel, because it's about the ordinary litigants that you mentioned in the introduction and that are foregrounded in the title of your book. So you choose three specific kind of groups: women, indigenous people, and the enslaved. And you tell us, you know, in separate chapters, how their civil cases were changing and how different groups of, for example, of women were in the late 18th century were like bringing suits against their husbands or partners, how enslaved people were increasingly, you know, suing the masters, either, you know, for pursuing freedom in certain ways, and how indigenous people also were kind of pushing the courts and the legal system to like hear what they thought they needed and they deserved, right, as subjects. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us about all of this example? I know it's like a huge question and half of the book, but a little bit of how these examples allowed you to show the transformation and how actually they changed, right? How did women started suing their husband more and with different types of arguments? How the enslaved did the same? How was freedom, how freedom became this huge thrust of their arguments, etc.? Right. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So I guess I could use an example of a kind of case from each of those subordinated groups, right? The idea here is that statistically speaking, the argument is not that the Enlightenment happened in Spanish America solely because of these cases. Nor is the argument that the growth in the really phenomenal growth in the number of civil cases in the second half of the 18th century in almost every court that I looked at, regardless, every civil court, regardless of its level, whether it was a district court or a high court or a city court, whether it was an highly indigenous area of Oaxaca or a kind of semi-provincial place like Trujillo or a viceregal capital. Almost everywhere you see this explosion of civil cases in the second half of the 18th century. And the argument is that the Enlightenment is part of this, but not that it's constitutive of all of that. It doesn't explain everything. Instead, what I'm trying to do is to carve off these cases in which subordinates sue superiors to show that those were rising faster than even the overall explosion of civil cases. And that's true in each instance. So in other words, if you looked at all of the cases from 1799 in any place, it's not going to be that they're all filled with enslaved people suing masters or women suing their husbands. But I can tell you that there are more of those kinds of cases than there would have been in the courts in 1650 or 1699, right? So what's happening there? What, you know, I can take an example from each one to argue about what's happening in the content of those cases that makes it Enlightenment. A good example in the case of women is the cases for what are called alimentos. And there you see the way that this project grew out of my prior book on custody cases. Alimentos were both child support and alimony. Mm-hmm. Well, alimony is a funny thing to have appear in civil cases. Obviously, there were always alimony cases over inheritance that was already part of law. But for the most part, when you saw alimentos until the second half of the 18th century anywhere in the Spanish Empire, it tended to be about inheritance, the inheritance of bequeathed to someone at the death of someone else, right? It was about property being inherited. And it really changes at the second half of the 18th century, where it becomes a lot more about ongoing support for spouses, for wives during separation or really in separation from their marital partners. And it's a space of law that happens. I'll put it a different way. It moves out the marital disputes outside of the realm of ecclesiastical law. And it makes, it has women, what we see are women appearing in court for alimony and for court expenses, for legal fees, for even going to court in the first place. Ordinary women suing their husbands, kind of apart from the whole question of whether or not they wanted to divorce them. And one of the main arguments that they're putting forward in these alimony cases has to do with their natural rights to preserve themselves. So when you begin to scratch away at those arguments, you see connections to all kinds of changes in legal thought over the course from, you know, the late 17th century all the way through, where it's no longer so much about natural law, but rather about the natural rights that accrue to individuals as kind of bounded individuals. So that's one kind of way, you know, I look at women's cases as revealing something very new, right? It's not just that there are new arguments. These are entirely new kinds of cases in some respects that didn't exist before. In the case of, I'll be more brief in the other two cases, but in the case of indigenous litigants, you know, the indigenous use of Spanish courts of law was always very vibrant and dynamic. But what you find are ordinary indigenous people who are suing the authorities in their villages or communities more vigorously at the end of the 18th century. And they're bringing merit-based arguments about their kind of suitability to govern in their communities or to be rewarded property, based no longer so much on status and tradition, but rather on their utility to the crown and their skills and ability. And so that kind of dovetails with the emphasis on merit that's happening in the Enlightenment overall. There's lots of temporal arguments in those cases that are really interesting to me too. And finally, the cases of enslaved litigants. Enslaved litigants, you know, made ample and creative use of ecclesiastical courts for a long time. But you see an explosion of civil claims for freedom or about abuse in the second half of the 18th century. And those cases are particularly fascinating. They encode all kinds of philosophical debates about human history and freedom.
Yeah, and like I cannot recommend enough for our listeners the chapters, because they are like a world in themselves. They kind of get to a lot of details and a lot of different particular cases that illustrate the argument in very like meaningful ways. So just maybe to finish up like the discussion about the book, I would like to ask you about how you finished the book, right? Because you finished with the question of why not enlightenment, right? Why, if this, you know, history was so important in the 18th century, right? If Spanish Americans produce the Enlightenment, why has it been so invisible, this history? Why has it taken so long for historians and, you know, Latin Americans to kind of think of this period and these kind of subjects as producers of Enlightenment?
Well, you know, it's so funny because I kind of was thinking about this when I was talking about not being a lawyer or not having a JD. And my assumption always that other people understood something that I wasn't understanding. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it could be in part not having a JD, maybe assuming that I was missing some kind of subtleties in the cases that had to do with language. You know, I'm not a native Spanish speaker. You know, I've been doing this for 30 years, so I'm pretty good with the, you know, with the 17th and 18th century stuff. But these kind of, I want to actually just call forward this notion of kind of what it is to assume that something exists elsewhere or is established elsewhere, and that there is that what you're doing is playing catch up or you're missing it, right? Mm-hmm. In that respect, I think that there is an analogy to be made to the longer history of Latin America's place in world history. Mm-hmm. And I think the analogy that I want to make, like why not enlightenment, is how did we miss this? Well, the answer is to be found kind of in that sense of insecurity, and in that sense that there's like an authentic Latin American history that should not connect essentially to these imposed Western civ kinds of themes, right? Mm-hmm. And that happens not only in the way that we frame Latin American history now, but it also was part of the way that I would argue the kind of really disruptive potential of these court cases at the moment was diffused by defendants. And so explain what I mean kind of in both registers. Now we are at a place where Latin America offers what one historian of Argentina referred to as kind of the endless search for the autochthonous originality, right? What is really Latin American? There seems like something capitulatory, something disappointing, or something politically conservative and in the worst way and wrong with saying that Latin America should contribute to these major themes of world history and have been progenitors of ideas like enlightenment, because it reverses where we've been, for almost, half a century in talking about Latin America as having value in and of itself and not in reference to the West or Europe, right? So that the study of native languages or other knowledges, I mean, even thinking about what LASA in Lima, I guess that would have been 2017, Latin American Studies Association, Otros Saberes, right? No, the other knowledges. This is absolutely important. It's a huge part of what I do, but it also kind of tells us what direction that the valuing of Latin America's other knowledges, the ones that don't connect to or that explode Western categories, are the ones right now that are valorized. Mm-hmm. So there's something kind of uncomfortable and obviously problematic about arguing that Latin America contributed to the Enlightenment and that ordinary people were contributing to the Enlightenment, because it seems like all it does is reinforce, as you quoted before, the idea that for Latin America to be important, it has to link into Western ideas. Mm-hmm. I struggled with that a lot in writing the book. How do we kind of acknowledge that Latin America was a site of generative ideas that got taken up and trademarked by the West? And I think that's right there the trick. I'm not the first, obviously, to make these kinds of arguments. I mean, everyone who should read Michel Rolf Trouillot and others who have talked about the trademarking of the experience of places in Latin America and the Caribbean as, part of European history. But I think that there's the trick is kind of embedded right in the history, which is to say that very, very almost simultaneous with the rise of these kinds of cases, you see the defendants, slave owners, husbands, caciques, or members of cabildos in indigenous communities, very quickly adopting many of the same ontological markers of the Enlightenment that litigants were, mm-hmm. and flipping them around and actually emphasizing certain of the elements that would lead us to imagine that the ideas that litigants were generating were mimicry or were given to them by others, that they were that they weren't really their ideas. So the question, who was doing the writing, becomes a loaded question in which it implies that because ordinary Latin Americans were not doing their own writing, they weren't doing their own thinking or their own legal arguing. And I really want us to interrogate that assumption. Why is it that we assume that slave owner or a philosophe in a cafe in Paris was the originator of his own ideas, but are so much less comfortable with imagining that an enslaved mother or an indigenous person who could not write would be the originator of their own ideas? And I think that's the legacy of this very trick of the Enlightenment, disabusing the intellectual history of ordinary people is really a kind of a very enlightened move on the part of the defendants.
Thank you. I mean, thank you for that intervention. I think it's so thought-provoking, and I think we really have to sit down with your book and kind of think through this very complex idea, because I do believe it's like a huge question for both people studying Latin America, for Latin American themselves. So I really appreciated that way of finishing your book. As I mentioned to you in our conversation, I've kind of want to implement a new type of question here in the New Books Network. And I would like to ask you, and that I think may be related to what you just said, but we'll see what you think. How does your book, do you think, how does this history you're telling us relates to the present? How does this story you're telling us kind of help us understand or not our current moment?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, our current moment is moving really fast, which is to say, I mean, the things that I was thinking about as I was struggling and, you know, had sleepless nights about the implications of this book have changed really fast. And I think it's fair to say that, like many people at this very juncture historically, you know, the ground is shifting so fast. I'm not sure I have it all worked out. But I can't, you know, in the respect that, I mean, I think that I had a kind of conviction that I had settled on when I was writing this book. And I'll be really clear about what I mean about that, which is that I think that there's two scales. One was the historiographical scale that I was just talking about. What does it mean after, you know, several decades of post-colonial scholarship to return to the question of other knowledges and say, hey, they're not so other. They're in fact talking in many of the same languages as everyone else in the West was, of course, you know, produced in very local and individually meaningful circumstances. Mm-hmm. But that's been written out of the history, right? And what do we do with the fact that we have all of these litigants who were perfectly comfortable kind of engaging with ideas that we could very easily label in as enlightened, yet nobody has ever wanted to do that. Both the, you know, the defendants in the moment up to us today have decided that that's not what their value is, right? That was a question that I really struggled with, and I came to a certain kind of set of convictions about that, that it was an important story to tell so that we could kind of revivify that conversation so that other knowledges were not just valued, you know, kind of unthinkingly, so that we are sure to be able to look at the whole range of the kinds of knowledges that Latin Americans were producing and not simply always exoticize and you know, fixate all the time on those that somehow are not resonant with larger Western categories or ontologies. That really seemed healthy to me at that moment. Mm-hmm. And part of the other, there was like the other scale was more a popular knowledge scale or a popular history. Mm-hmm. I would kind of get caught up in the politics of all of that. What does it mean to be, you know, am I just simply reinscribing Western categories and Western civ textbooks and, oh my God, what am I doing here? And but then I would kind of comfort myself and say, you know, Bianca, ordinary folks today who know about history don't know anything, except that they think that the Enlightenment is what led to anti-monarchical revolution and democracy.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like, period. So just the mere fact that you're kind of opening people up to the idea that it was produced by ordinary people and not by some small number of, you know, Thomas Paine's and, you know, whether or not you count Rousseau or, you know, Kant, right? Just that alone has to be valuable. That to me felt really important. Like that, just the assertion that, you know, ordinary people really were producing the ideas that we have now, again, trademarked to only a few, and that you too can be part of the intellectual history in these small ways. That intellectual history and the places that we go to are influenced by everyday action, and that ordinary people, no matter how educated or how fluent in speaking to the paradigm that they live in, actually have intellectual histories, to me seemed really important, and it still does. But I have to say, the last couple of years since this book was produced has made me, I was doing the copy edits for this book exactly at around the 2016 US election. And looking at what's been happening in Brazil, thinking about what's been happening throughout Latin America, thinking about how we imagine people, I think that there is also something fundamentally important about this being a global story and not one that is about otherness necessarily at this moment. I think that the idea that we have any kind of shared history, it is important. It's an important counter narrative. I think we have to grapple right now with the potential abuse of the idea that we are producing our own histories, or Latin America produces a history that's somehow disconnected, written into the idea of otros saberes. Mm-hmm. We need to be able to toggle between our shared human values and our shared human story, mm-hmm. and our otherness in ways that are productive. Because if we don't, there are plenty of thinkers in our world today who are heavily invested in the differences in our stories and not their similarities.
I mean, that's so interesting. And I really appreciated that you take the time to think this question, because I know sometimes we as historians are more comfortable about commenting about the past. And it's a little bit more difficult in this kind of context mm-hmm. to comment on the present. And I think what you just said will give our listeners a lot to think about. So just to very quickly finish off, can you tell us what you're working on right now and what are we expecting from you in the next few years?
Well, I am returning to the history of childhood, which was part of the first book, and I'm actually moving to the 20th century for a little while, mm-hmm. and doing some work on girlhood, on puberty, on medicine, on medical ethics, all kinds of things like that, which are new to me and are going to be quite challenging. And working, speaking of sources and, asking what you know and don't know, working in a period that has photographs is just completely blowing my mind. And I feel like, it's a totally different discipline. It's not even history anymore. But I continue to work. Any readers who are interested in the Enlightenment on trial, law, 18th century Spanish America, there's so many unresolved mm-hmm. Pieces or great places that I can burrow down. I am working right now on a reflection about the importance of age as a legal category, as a legal mm-hmm. argument, really, that during precisely this period, and about those corporate identities and justice oriented practice, and how a lot of times when we think about age and the history of age, we actually are kind of secretly thinking about citizenship. And I am writing something about how to read legal documents for age in the past when citizenship was not on the agenda, right? What do we do with all of this justice-based world in which it was really actually advantageous for an adult person to talk about being a minor or being an orphan or being unprotected, desamparado, right? It seems to us to almost be so kind of capitulatory and regressive, and it must be the product of infantilizing discourses on a part of the colonial state. But I think it's actually probably a lot more complicated than that. I'm also very interested and I hope to publish on the something that didn't come up in the book, but that I think I might have been, kind of secretly working around, which is the relationship between a lot of this argumentation and capitalism. There's especially with this, a lot of these enslaved cases, but the idea of speculation, mm-hmm. speculation mm-hmm. in prices and what that means temporally. Was really embedded in a lot of these cases, and so I've tried to carve that off and force myself to speak to the history of the development of capitalism. I think that a lot of these litigants were making market arguments mm-hmm. and advancing the idea of a kind of unbiased market that could operate outside of the logic of old casuistic justice. And in doing so, you know, like we always are, probably making their own beds for the future. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that may, in just as much as they created the Enlightenment, they may have had a hand in creating some of the capitalist logic that we inherit today.
Well, I'm very looking forward to all of those projects. And I know we'll be hearing much more about you in the next few years. So thank you very much for joining us today. And this was a terrific interview.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you for your questions and for engaging with my work. I really appreciate it.